runner, you've probably nonetheless found benefit in having occasional company, especially for harder or longer workouts. On any given day, runs with others provide a mood boost. Running is often my favorite social hour, says one of my training partners, Heather Johnson, who runs in part to manage anxiety. Another, Kristen Berry, who has depression, says, socializing with friends while running makes me feel more connected and happier in general. Just think if they got to run with someone more interesting than me. We saw in Chapter 6 how training together often results in conversations that are more open and substantive than the norm in our sedentary hours. Running with others has served as a way to bring my own struggles and achievements to others to gain alternative perspectives, Johnson says. Over the years, social and group runs have given me new ways to approach parenting, working with others, and how to be a better overall person. What's key here is that these more intimate conversations happen while we're doing something that in and of itself creates a connection. Runners know that you can learn more about a person in the space of a few 10-milers than in 6 months of having adjoining cubicles. The shared effort of a track workout or a long run builds a bond that's stronger than if we were in a book club or cooking class together. Combine the talk and the work, and you can build deep friendships in a surprisingly short time. Running's delivery mechanism for a regular supply of new friends is a profound enough mental health aid. In my 50s, I have an easy way to continue to broaden my pool of relationships at a time when many of my contemporaries are seeing their social circles shrink. Some running partners remain primarily that. When we encounter each other in what I call civilian life, we often do a double take because of being unaccustomed to seeing each other in street clothes. I often think, there's a really thin person, before recognizing the other. Some running partners blossom into all-hours friends who socialize while barely talking about running. But there's more to it than just numbers. As Johnson says, running has given me the opportunity to connect with so many different people. In the past year, I've run with people in their 20s and people in their 70s, as well as all ages between. Some are women, some are men. Some are married, some divorced, some never married. Some have grown children, some are childless, some have infants. Some began running as teens, some started recently. We grew up in different times and different places and spend our days doing different work. Our lives are so much richer for the varied friendships we continually develop through running. How else would it be the case that the best friend I've made in the past decade is a mother of two who was born after I started running? How many depressed men my age have a way to nurture such relationships in just 1 or 2 hours a week? These too brief in-person encounters don't exist in a vacuum. They spur actions and thoughts that improve the time when we're apart. If you're like me, you're constantly checking in with your running partners. How did that workout go? Is your leg feeling better? Want to go long this weekend? Was it crazy cold this morning or what? Running provides an easy and obvious reason to stay in regular contact. As on the run, the basic questions tend to lead to reports on non-running aspects of our lives, making our connections to one another that much stronger. Even the most basic planning to run with others helps. Knowing on a Wednesday that Saturday morning will include 90 minutes of fellowship brightens the week like little else. I used to plan to train with others primarily as a means to a racing goal. Now, it's a worthwhile goal in itself. Finding your friends. Scheduling runs with others is standard advice for anyone who struggles with consistency. You're more likely to stick with a run if you know your friend is also getting up early and will be waiting for you. This old trick has special pertinence for runners with depression. As we saw in Chapter 2, a key way to lessen depressive symptoms is activation, or participating in enjoyable activities. Doing so breaks the downward cycle of withdrawal, isolation, and lethargy. Committing to meeting someone to run once or twice a week increases the chances you'll get out the door on at least those days. And those days can spur a positive feedback loop of more activity and improved mood. How best to find such people? New running partners can appear organically as you run with one friend who brings along a friend, and you and the other person hit it off and start making running dates. More formally, you could explore regular runs put on by running clubs, stores, or other organizations. Depending on how outgoing you are, try talking with people who finish right near you in a local race. You're probably well matched in terms of training pace, so if geography and logistics align, you could be set. Start by asking the person to join you on a post-race cool down. One of my best friendships started more than a quarter century ago when I said to the guy who'd finished one place ahead of me at a 10-miler, "Want to go jog?" An interesting side note. It turns out that the running tradition of the social cool down might help you recover more quickly from a race or hard workout. This idea was popularized by University of Houston coach Steve Magnus, who encourages his runners to jog together after a hard effort. Magnus cites studies, such as one of rugby players, that have found increased testosterone levels when athletes socialize rather than isolate themselves after competition. Time together can also be eating or having coffee soon after a draining run. A boost in your testosterone level is theoretically helpful because testosterone is among the hormones that speed recovery. Have more of it circulating and you'll bounce back from a track session, race, or long run faster. You can usually tell after a few runs together whether someone's going to become a friend or remain an acquaintance. We all have different standards and needs. For many people, just having someone show up a couple days a week is a big help. But isn't it great when, on your third run together, you realize you're having the social highlight of your week? Your mood has significantly improved, and you can't wait to plan the next run. The many modes of helpful running groups. My little antisocial media screed doesn't mean there's no value in online running groups. They're most helpful when they supplement rather than replace in-person relationships. When Patty Haas was training for the New York City Marathon to climb out of depression caused by a miscarriage, she used a program provided by the race organizers, the New York Roadrunners. See the next chapter for more on how Haas used marathon training to overcome a mental health crisis. Haas felt she would benefit from additional support beyond the training program. The logistics of her life meant doing all of her running by herself, so she found another way to connect with fellow runners. She joined a Facebook group of people following the same program. These were people I didn't know in real life, but we all had the same goal, she says. She felt accountable to the group, which helped when she was low on motivation. We would share what we were doing, so I felt like I had to, especially on Sundays when everybody would post about their long runs, Haas says. I wanted to share nice pictures from my long runs, so instead of running my usual runs in the neighborhood, I would get out a little farther and run in Princeton. Being in a pretty setting that was different from my normal life helped in itself. During her marathon buildup, Haas found that different social ties as well as different scenery helped decrease her depression. Instead of dealing with the same people I was dealing with before the miscarriage, I had the excuse to form a different group of relationships with people with the same goal as mine, she says. Some of them became my best friends. Another Facebook group has as its organizing principle not runners training for the same race, but runners battling depression. In 2017, Adam Weitz of Orange County, California, created the group Sad Runner to complement his website of the same name. To Weitz, Sad Runner doesn't mean wallowing in one's depression. It means applying the mindset of a runner to dealing with depression, such as tackling uphills in running and life, rather than avoiding them, and finding a way to keep moving forward. The Facebook group, Weitz says, is focused on positivity and action. So many depression groups are just places for people to complain about their condition. Our group focuses on motivating one another to keep going, despite our depression. There aren't any victims in our group. We inspire one another to turn into fighters who live our lives, no matter what depression throws at us. One of the best unconventional groups I discovered is Run For It, a Canadian program that uses running to help girls aged 12 to 19 learn about and address mental health issues. Started in 2015, Run For It is now offered in 17 Canadian cities. Participants meet twice a week for 6 weeks, with each meeting part training session and part lesson on mental health. The program culminates with participants running one of the 5Ks in Canada's Run for Women series. Run For It is not to be confused with Girls on the Run, a U.S. program for elementary and middle school age girls that uses prepping for a 5K as a way to build self-esteem and teach life skills, such as forming good relationships. Valerie Taylor, MD, the head psychiatrist at Women's College Hospital in Toronto, created the mental health curriculum in consultation with other Canadian mental health experts. The training program was developed by The Running Room, Canada's largest chain of running stores. Another popular Canadian chain, Shoppers Drug Mart, is also a sponsor, and the program has a buy-in from local high schools and police departments. Taylor says the program plans to expand to include boys, at which time a curriculum appropriate for both sexes will be developed. The goal of Run For It, Taylor says, is to raise awareness of and decrease the stigma associated with mental health issues. In addition, she says, we want to teach them about being proactive in their own health and engaging in physical activity to augment medication or decrease the need for medication. One of the things we're trying to raise awareness of is that for symptoms of mild to moderate depression, you may not need medication. Or if you have had more serious depression in the past and are still not feeling well, exercise can be a piece that helps you get back to the level of functioning you want. The curriculum educates the girls on such topics as how running improves mental health, warning signs of mental health problems, how to talk about a difficult subject, for example, mental health, and distinguishing good stress from bad stress. The short mental health lessons end with discussion questions that the girls are encouraged to talk about during their training sessions, which immediately follow the lessons. The creators of Run For It settled on running in part because it's accessible and known to be effective for mental health issues, even in small amounts. There's a lot of misinformation out there about what exercise looks like, Taylor explains. People are often told to do crazy things, like the Biggest Loser mentality. If you're going to start an exercise program, you have to go all out, or it's not effective. For me, running is one of the least intimidating activities. You don't have to go to the gym. You don't have to be super rich or buy a lot of equipment or join a team. It's available to most people. You just have to follow a smart program. The group aspect of the program is key to reinforcing its messages. The girls run together, which helps to get them talking, Taylor says. That helps break down stigma and make them feel more comfortable having conversations about some fairly challenging topics, like their mental health. I've seen people have conversations on the run that were very therapeutic, that they'd probably otherwise never be able to have. Although the 5K races the program culminates with also offer a 1 kilometer walk, Taylor says almost all participants aim for the more ambitious running option. The young girls felt like they wanted to challenge themselves and work toward a 5K run, she says. Appropriate goal setting is really important, and I feel pretty strongly that unless they've got a serious injury, anybody can learn to run 5K over the course of a number of months if they do it properly and safely. Goal setting isn't just important for teen girls aiming for their first 5K. It's a key part of using running to manage one's mental health and the subject of the next chapter. Chapter 10. Running and Meaningful Pursuits. When people find out you're a runner, one of the first questions they ask is some version of, how many miles a day do you run? The question assumes that we all go out and do the same run day after day after day. It's part of the general perception of running as joyless castor oil consumption, an aerobic equivalent of flossing at bedtime, and other things we do because we should, not because we want to. Most runners, of course, naturally mix things up. You run different courses at different paces, depending on such variables as available time, energy level, previous day's workouts, weather, and whim. If you're like me, you usually give the well-meaning inquirer the answer to a slightly different question. I do around 60 miles a week, I might reply. That sometimes leads to the other person saying, that's 8 miles a day. Depending on how patient the questioner appears and how pedantic I'm feeling, I'll say something like, well, it varies. Some days I go longer than that, some days shorter. I should know by now how to give people nice enough to ask about my running a brief answer and move on. Then again, they started it. I have this nagging mission to present running how I experience it, partially because I'd rather be ignored than misunderstood, and partially because more people might become runners if they knew the many ways it's wonderful. In my dream discussion, I convince the other person how running is one of the few things in life that can regularly give you something to work toward and look forward to in a personally meaningful way where the outcome is almost entirely based on you. In his book Why We Run, renowned biologist and former champion ultramarathoner Bernd Heinrich writes, "We are psychologically evolved to pursue long-range goals, because through millions of years, that is what we on average had to do in order to eat." According to Heinrich, hunter-gatherers had to persist in chasing down game despite the prey's often seeming out of reach. Heinrich's original title for Why We Run was Chasing the Antelope, which he had to revise after threatened legal action by the author of Run Like an Antelope, a book about the jam band Phish. The ancestral experience of working toward a challenging goal, where success was neither guaranteed nor imminent, permanently shaped human psychology, Heinrich says. In this view, being fully human entails pursuing such quests even, or perhaps especially, in an age of immediate gratification. When I visited him at his cabin in western Maine, Heinrich spoke about the need for substitute chases in modern life. Meaningful work or other projects, he believes, are essential for our mental health. That's especially the case for those of us with depression and anxiety, for whom the calendar can extend into infinity, with nothing but dread or despondency in view. Fortunately, as runners, we have a built-in way to create substitute chases. Giving meaning to time. The sense that the unsatisfying present is your eternal fate is common during tough times. We can drown in such thoughts as, I have nothing to look forward to, or, it doesn't matter what I do, or, it's always going to be like this. When you're struggling, you probably think like that about both life in general and your mental health, with the latter thoughts making the former ones worse. Enter Heinrich's substitute chases, or what others more prosaically call good goals. By definition, they give you something to look forward to, and they directly contradict the perspective that, regardless of what you do, things are always going to be like they are right now. Notice I wrote good goals. For our purposes here, good goals have these elements. Good goals are trackable. The nature of the goal gives you a built-in way to know objectively whether you met it. That aspect usually means you can easily set interim goals as you work toward your ultimate goal. So, for example, setting as a goal, finish a half marathon, meets this criterion and would give you signposts to shoot for along the way. For example, being able to run 10 miles. Good goals have a deadline. You should have a date by which you want to accomplish the goal. It should be far enough away to account for the work needed to achieve it, more on that in a bit, but near enough to bring a sense of urgency to your work toward it. Building on my example of a goal, if the longest you've run is 6 miles, then to finish a half marathon 3 months from now meets this criterion. You have time to build up your long run, but not so much time that it doesn't matter if you blow off running for 2 months. Good goals require you to push yourself, within reason. If you run 12 miles every Saturday, then the goal, finish a half marathon 3 months from now, is pointless. You could accomplish it tomorrow. A good goal takes into account where you currently are and requires you to put in regular work to expand your capabilities. It's got to be difficult enough to make it challenging, interesting, Heinrich says. At the same time, it shouldn't be too ambitious. You're going from 6 miles to finishing a half marathon in 3 months will be challenging, but you should be able to meet your goal if you're diligent. If you instead set the goal, win a half marathon in 3 months, you're delusional. Good goals help you to change what reality is, but they can't be completely disconnected from reality. Good goals are personally meaningful. This last point is crucial, even if your goal in finding a good goal is to improve your mental health. A good goal is one that speaks to you, that you'll keep working toward when the work is hard, because somewhere deep inside you want to attain it. It's something you really want to do to make life more interesting, enjoyable, and or meaningful. If you, the would-be half-marathoner, set that goal because you think you should, to count as a real runner because it seems that everybody else is doing it, etc., then you've let someone else set your goal. It's no coincidence that I used a race to illustrate these elements of a good goal. They're the most obvious and readily available aspect of running for goal seekers. Running faster and or farther than you ever have is one of the most intoxicating feelings available. A constant calendar of upcoming races to focus on has helped many depressed or anxious runners, including me, for several years, lift themselves from the mire. Races aren't the only available substitute chase for runners. After failing twice in the spring of 2000 to set a marathon personal best, I set the non-competitive goal of running the 184-mile towpath of Maryland's C&O Canal in a week. Doing so entailed averaging just more than a marathon a day for 7 days and covering 50% more miles in a week than I'd ever done. Those numbers didn't scare so much as motivate me. I wanted running the canal to be enjoyable rather than a grind. That meant I had to get fit enough to handle repeated days of long runs and disciplined enough between long runs to do all the recovery tricks that would have me ready to go again the next morning. It all worked. The week in November 2000 I spent cruising through nature for no better reason than to do so remains a life highlight. Non-competitive goals needn't be so extreme, of course. You might try to run every day for a month, or a season, or a year, or run more miles in a month than you ever have, or cover your favorite course 10 seconds per mile faster than your best time on it. What's key is that your goal have the elements just described. That sort of quest will add meaning to your days and, as you see that you're not trapped in the eternal present, allow you to make progress in other areas of your life. Running to recovery. Patty Haas is a perfect example of how working toward a running goal can be the catalyst for overcoming a mental health crisis. In June 2015, the finance professional from Kendall Park, New Jersey, had a miscarriage while 2 months pregnant. She became severely depressed and started missing work. I didn't want to get out of bed. I didn't want to go out of my house, she says. It was that feeling that there's no point in continuing. I had no motivation to do anything other than take care of my kids, which was more an automatic duty than the desire to do it. Guilt over being depressed, feeling like I'm the worst mother in the world, compounded the situation. After a few weeks, Paz knew she needed to do something different at least for my children, if not me. She started seeing a counselor who asked her about hobbies and non-work activities she enjoyed before the miscarriage. The therapist told me, "You have to continue doing those things even if you don't feel like it," Haas says. Haas had secured an entry to that fall's New York City Marathon, her first attempt at the distance. When she became pregnant, she figured she would skip the race. After her miscarriage and the ensuing depression, "I just stayed with the assumption that I wasn't going to do it," she says. The therapist convinced her otherwise. She said running even just a little would be good, but having this goal and pushing myself would really help me. Haas signed up for a virtual training program offered by the New York Road Runners, the race organizers. "I needed somebody to tell me exactly what to do," she says. "I didn't feel like I could get myself to do it on my own. I would get a daily email saying how far to run. It was easier for me to just follow their orders. Very, very often, I didn't feel like waking up, but I'd look at my phone and see the email say, 'Today you have to run 4 miles in X amount of time.' That would get me out of bed and out there running." Once on the roads, Haas enjoyed the mobile change in thinking we looked at in earlier chapters. "I would start my run with all these negative thoughts, and somehow, after 1 or 1.5 miles, I was able to start thinking about something else. My pace, how much farther I had to go, any other thing." She also regularly reframed the thoughts that were keeping her depressed. "If I was driving or working or waking up in the middle of the night and thinking about the things that were making me sad, it would just make things worse. It would become like a spiral, and there was no end to it," she says. "When I was running, I would think about those same things, but somehow I was able to process them differently. I realized the best time to process those thoughts was during runs." The ambitious goal of running her first marathon wound up giving Haas a significant boost in self-efficacy. "If I was running for the sake of running, I would have stopped with my 6-mile run," she says. "I would have never tried to do 16, 18, 20 miles. I was accomplishing things I'd never done before. I'd never run farther than 13 miles, and all of a sudden I was running at least 13 miles every weekend. Pushing myself and seeing that I could keep going farther gave me satisfaction in other areas. I'm sure that helped me get better." Haas wound up finishing the marathon in 6 hours, 38 minutes, a huge accomplishment for someone who had been bedbound just months earlier. "I think running for the sake of running definitely helps, but it helped a lot more having this big goal," she says. "I joked with my therapist. One of the very first things you have to tell your patients is they have to go out and train for a marathon. Runners, we're alike." You might think that because he's an elite runner whose livelihood depends on racing well, Bob Krar wouldn't get the same boost from a buildup that Haas did. But he does, and counts it as central to managing his depression. "When things are going well, there's almost like a synergy that works in a good way," says the 2-time winner of the Western States Endurance Run, a 100-miler in California that's considered the most prestigious ultramarathon in the United States. "I don't know if that's by coincidence or if internally some part of me deep down is able to recognize the importance of a big race." Krar is subject to nearly incapacitating depressive episodes, but he almost never gets them soon before a major race. "I think it's the momentum and excitement leading up to it," he says. "If I can make it until a week or two before the race without crashing, it seems like the energy and anticipation is enough to carry me through." Although Krar would prefer not to have mental health problems, he does offer the intriguing thought that his prowess late in ultramarathons might stem in part because of his experience with depression. "When he's really struggling with depression, he sometimes sits by his door with his running shoes on, and I'm just feeling powerless, literally not being able to step outside the door to run," he says. In his longest races, the pain steadily increases through 50, 60, 70 miles, and you get to a point where you think, wow, 30 more miles. How am I ever going to run 30 more miles? But rather than link that thought to his bad days at home, Krar reframes it. The last miles of an ultra are a long, hard struggle, he says. Unlike on my worst days with depression, in the race, I have the power to make the pain and suffering stop at any moment. I choose to continue to recognize it and work with it, and I'm okay with it. It's a unique time to be in a really dark place, but be in control of it. It's comforting. I think that's what keeps me going back, to have that experience and have more control over it than I often do. The goal setting and process inherent in being a competitive runner are a big help to Rich Harfst in his lifelong struggle with depression. Having consistent goals is therapeutic in two ways, the Annandale, Virginia resident says. First, the direct endorphin flow of going out and doing something, that often gets me over a hump. Second, things like writing a training schedule and tweaking it over and over and over again, or planning out races, or reading about and studying running, that systemic approach lets me apply consistent energy towards something which is also helpful to my mental health. In his mid-50s, Harfst is still aiming to get his marathon personal best below 3 hours. He also finds purpose in other ways of tracking his performances, such as being competitive in his age group at local races, or seeing how his times rate on age grade tables, which attempt to compare times at common distances across age groups. He also, and rightfully, draws meaning from general comparison to my peers at work who are taking the elevator to take a cigarette break. For now, racing goals push Harfst to run more and harder than he otherwise would. The extra volume and intensity provide their own boost to his mental health. That ability to measure results is highly motivating, he says. On any given day, why run if I'm running just to be fit? There's not much of a difference toward that end if I run or don't run next Saturday. Without racing goals, I'd probably figure out another substitute for that, but the racing bit makes it pretty clean. Rob Krar often suffers after he's achieved a big goal. More times than not, I go into a post-race struggle like many people do, he says. There's something about having been focused for so long. When I do my best in a race tends to be when I fall the most following a race. Krar's experiences are a reminder to anticipate running's version of postpartum depression. Before completing your current goal, try to have a candidate or two ready for something you can focus on next. It needn't be as ambitious as your current goal, and it should probably be qualitatively different, perhaps in a non-running area of your life. But it should be something you'll find meaning in engaging with when you start to notice the glow fading from meeting your earlier goal. Variety is the spice of running. Haas, Harfst, and Krar illustrate how focusing on a personally meaningful race can mitigate depression or anxiety. A less obvious aspect of preparing for a race can also provide relief. Its effects are significant enough that it's worth considering doing, even if you have no current race goals. Think back to the person at the beginning of this chapter who asked how many miles a day you run. When you're training for a race, odds are that a full answer would point out that not only do you vary distance by day, you also have different types of workouts. Say you're prepping for a half marathon. A typical week might include a long run on the weekend, a tempo run or workout of long intervals on one weekday, a day of shorter, faster repeats elsewhere in the work week, a steady distance run, and a couple of short, slow recovery runs. You might do some of these runs by yourself and some with one or more training partners. You might be on the track for the short, fast repeats, on trails for your long run, and on neighborhood roads for recovery runs. Such a schedule will get you ready to race well, and looking ahead to the race is running's no-brainer version of a Bernd Heinrich substitute chase. Such a schedule will also be a daily antidote to the self-defeating idea that all your days are the same. Training to race gives your running a day-to-day purpose, a short-term version of the long-term focus a meaningful goal provides. You might feel that the rest of your life is a tire spinning deeper and deeper in a muddy rut, but you probably won't feel that way about your running when today you're running short and slow to recover from yesterday's interval workout, and tomorrow you'll be doing a steady 8-miler, and you have a weekend long run scheduled with friends to look forward to. The structure of training provides purpose to every day and the promise that tomorrow will be different. Training to race can also boost your daily mood more than doing the same runs day after day. Not that there's anything wrong with that. We saw in Chapter 4 that many runners report feeling happiest after their hardest and longest workouts. The sense of accomplishment that comes from knocking out a good tempo run before work or spending Saturday morning running farther than you have all year can stay with you all day. Seeing that, yes, you were able to overcome inertia and do this difficult thing can inspire you to attempt other assaults on complacency. Let's not discount the mental break that hard workouts and long runs can provide when your negative thoughts are stuck. Long runs seem to be particularly helpful for me, my training partner Meredith Anderson says about temporary relief from her anxiety. You're so tired doing this one thing that you don't have the space or capacity to worry about whatever's bothering you. For my part, hard sessions, tempo runs, intervals at 5K pace, short repeats at mile pace, are best at shunting my thoughts away from rumination on reality shortcomings. Focusing on things like my split times, effort level, form, and breathing leaves room for little else. Of course, in one way, shifting my attention during that intense half hour doesn't solve the problem that bedraggled me pre-workout. I would still benefit from feeling lonely less often, and so on. In another way, though, problem solved if the main problem was the negative thinking the workout pushed aside. A friend of mine used to tell his wife it was easier to run 80 miles a week than 50. His counterintuitive reasoning was that being fit enough to average more than 11 miles a day meant that any given run took relatively less out of him. He could work very hard on individual days, but recover quickly and be readier for more of the same the following day than was the case at lower mileage. My point here isn't that you should start doing 80-mile weeks. It's that training to race, with runs of different lengths and intensity throughout the week, can provide that same extra oomph to your fitness level. You'll then be able to more regularly be on autopilot, cruising through your runs at the sustained intensity level most associated with running's feel-good effect. When I prepared for a trail ultramarathon in the spring of 2017, I got to where regular 3-plus-hour runs became no more taxing than 90 minutes had been during the winter. The feeling of increased capability was with me on all runs once I'd made the leap in fitness. That build-up was the happiest I'd been running in a few years. Training for non-racers. All that being the case, here's my suggestion for runners with depression or anxiety. Run as if you're training for a race, even when you're not. When one of my training partners, Kristen Berry, temporarily put aside racing to concentrate on her legal career, she kept the structure that helped her qualify for 2 Olympic marathon trials. Her husband asked her why she was still doing track workouts early in the morning before going to work. "This is what I've been doing for 25 years," she told him. "It's the way I know how to run." Barry and I discussed this topic over a run. For the record, an easy run, the day after both of us had done a hard workout despite having no races coming up. We agreed that continuing to structure our training as if we were preparing to race is a model that makes sense for us, especially as people with depression. We get the same day-to-day physical and mental variety that frequent racers do. Several different running experiences within a given week help distinguish that part of our lives from the all the days are the same phenomenon that can initiate or worsen depressive thoughts. The big difference, of course, is that we're not building toward a race. We're sure to include substitute chases, a career milestone for Barry, writing a book for me, during these breaks from competition. Barry and I know we're going to run regularly anyway. It's easier, more enjoyable, and more beneficial for us to do so with every day being distinct but simultaneously related to other days. A basic version of this approach to running will look familiar if you've followed many training programs. One day, early in the week, usually Monday or Tuesday, I do a tempo run of 20 to 35 minutes at around half marathon effort, or longer intervals, 4 to 6 repeats of 3 to 5 minutes at 5K to 10K effort. Later in the week, I do shorter repeats, 30 seconds to 1 minute at mile effort. On the weekend, I do my longest run of the week, usually between 90 minutes and 2 hours. Other days, I go as far and fast, read slow, as feels best given what I did the day before and what I have planned for the following day. I stated my harder workouts in terms of effort, not pace, but I mostly do my faster runs by time on roads. If greater precision brings you more happiness, run their equivalents, 800-meter repeats, 4-mile tempo runs, etc., on the track or another calibrated course. Running as if you're training for a race, even when you're not, may seem weird. It certainly perplexes some fellow runners when they learn I run 60 miles a week, do hard workouts, and have no interest in how fast I can run a 10K. They might understand it better if they ran primarily to improve their mental health. One of the great appeals of running when I began as a teen was how it gave structure to my life. The 1 or 2 runs I did each day determined much of what I did and didn't do in my non-running hours. The runs themselves, how far, how fast, how often, were somewhat dictated by my goals. Within each day, each week, each month, my activities cohered as building blocks to a better future. At some point, I started overthinking this way of thinking. Wasn't I just distracting myself from more important things? What does the universe care about my running? How is my running improving the world? Beyond times on a watch, how is my running improving me? Why do I give running so much meaning and energy when I so easily scoff at how others spend their time? Now that I'm middle-aged, I find myself mostly back to my teen perspective. The main difference is that I often don't have a big race in mind, despite the impression my training log might give. I'm now completely comfortable with the idea that being a dedicated runner isn't a distraction. It's living. It's how I structure the most important substitute chase of all, that of outrunning depression. Chapter 11. Running and a Healthy Lifestyle. When people talk about lifestyle interventions to improve mental health, exercise is usually at the top of the list. So, we runners are fortunate enough to already have that important practice in place. As runners, we know that getting in our miles is key, but that what we do when we're not running is also important. Elite runners talk about the little things, stretching, strengthening, form drills, diet, recovery, etc., that add up to a big effect on their training and racing. The principle applies to those of us who use running to help manage depression or anxiety. Other lifestyle choices can have a significant effect on both our running and our mental health. In this chapter, we'll look at several aspects of a healthy lifestyle, how they can help your mental health, and how being a runner can make success in implementing them more likely. Improvements in your running or mental health after implementing these elements might be a placebo effect rooted in self-efficacy. But so what? If you feel better, you feel better. If that's a result of doing such things as eating well and sleeping better, at the least you're helping your overall health, independent of your mileage and mind. Diet and depression. If you want the quickest route to argument with runners, don't ask about training methods or charity marathoners. Go with diet. You'll get responses ranging from every morsel need be painstakingly analyzed before it's consumed, because the athletic body is a temple, to nonchalance bordering on self-sabotage, on the theory that running absolves you from responsibility for all other lifestyle choices. Most mainstream dietitians will tell you that the best diet for runners is the best diet for everybody, one high in fresh produce, lean proteins, and whole grains, with moderate amounts of unsaturated fat, and low on processed foods, fatty meats, and added sugar. Over time, many runners gravitate toward this general diet because it supports the energy level and health needed for good training, causes fewer gastrointestinal issues, and makes weight management easier than lots of fast food and packaged items with unpronounceable names. As it turns out, there's evidence that the basic diet you might gravitate toward as a runner should help with depression. As Australian and New Zealand researchers put it in a 2017 study, although there are many versions of a healthful diet in different countries and cultures, the available evidence from observational studies suggests that diets higher in plant foods, such as vegetables, fruits, legumes, and whole grains, and lean proteins, including fish, are associated with a reduced risk for depression, whilst dietary patterns that include more processed food and sugary products are associated with an increased risk of depression. These associations appear to be independent of potentially intervening variables, such as socioeconomic status. Of course, we all have our comfort foods, especially when our depression or anxiety is particularly strong. Mine is crunchy peanut butter straight out of the jar with a spoon. I'm not about denying myself pleasure. I figure the world does enough of that already. While indulging, I try to use this standard. What amount will lead to less overall time being depressed? Too little peanut butter is worse than none. I've teased myself with the prospect of short-term relief, but provided none. Too much is worse than either too little or none, because I'll feel bloated and lethargic the rest of the day, including while running, and when repeated too often will lead to complaining to my wife about gaining weight. My happy medium is nonetheless what most people would consider too much. Good diets call for real foods over supplements. A potential exception for depressed people is vitamin D in the winter, when limited ultraviolet B rays make it hard to meet your needs through sunlight. Vitamin D deficiency is associated with an increased risk of depression. Getting the prescribed daily intake of 1,000 international units, IU, of vitamin D through diet alone is difficult, even with fortified foods. For example, a 6-ounce salmon steak, which is one of the leading dietary sources of vitamin D, contains about 425 IUs. A large boiled egg, another top source of vitamin D, has about 260 IUs. The only dietary supplement I take is a daily 1,000 IU vitamin D pill, packaged as vitamin D3 in the winter. We'll look at another aspect of winter and vitamin D later in this chapter. Coffee and caffeine consumption. Runners love their coffee, and for good reason. Research has shown that caffeine can lower perceived exertion. That is, caffeine itself doesn't necessarily make you run faster, but it can make running a given pace feel easier, which, in practical terms, makes you more likely to keep that pace for longer. In long races, such as the marathon, coffee can help preserve some of your muscle glycogen, your body's form of stored carbohydrate, by increasing blood levels of free fatty acids, which can be used for fuel. This nice little trick can push the marathon's infamous wall closer to the finish line. For more workaday runs, coffee is valued for increasing pre-run alertness, which is always appreciated at 5 a.m. or after a long workday, and for moving things along the gastrointestinal tract. Don't leave the house until the coffee has left you, a professional marathoner once told me. Outside of running, coffee is believed to have health benefits. In studies comparing people who do and don't drink coffee, the coffee drinkers have been found to have less incidence of such diseases as type 2 diabetes, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and a few types of cancer. So you probably don't need me to convince you to drink coffee. For our purposes here, it's worth saying that runners with depression might be helping their mental health by being regular coffee drinkers. One review of research concluded that coffee consumption up to 400 milliliters, about 13.5 ounces a day, is associated with a lower risk of depression. Another research review found that the risk of depression decreased by 8% for each cup per day increment in coffee intake. The latter review expressed the greatest benefits in milligrams of caffeine, not volume of coffee. The risk of depression decreased faster, and the association became significant when the caffeine consumption was above 68 milligrams per day and below 509 milligrams per day, the researchers wrote. By way of comparison, 16 ounces of Starbucks Pike Place roast contains 310 milligrams of caffeine. As is true in much of the research on coffee and health, there appears to be some benefit for depression specific to coffee, not just caffeine. The first research review also examined tea and caffeine consumption and found the strongest association between drinking coffee and lowered depression risk. One possible explanation? Some research has found higher levels of baseline inflammation in people with depression. Coffee, but not, say, a caffeine pill, contains antioxidants, which are thought to lower some forms of inflammation. Note that the ranges cited in the research equate to moderate consumption. Ever more coffee won't help your mental health any more than it will your running. Even just a little too much can interfere with another lifestyle element that running can improve, and thereby help your mental health. Sleep. Getting better sleep. In surveys, as many as 90% of people with depression say they have sleep problems. These problems often have to do with insufficient, poor quality sleep, trouble falling asleep, waking frequently during the night, and or waking for good earlier than desired. About 15% of people having a major depressive episode report hypersomnia, sleeping much more than usual and or feeling sleepy most of the time they're awake. It's believed that bad sleep and depression are bidirectionally associated. That is, depression can detract from sleep quality, and poor sleep can worsen depression. The latter point is supported by reports of poor sleep by people before they have a depressive episode. Psychological aspects can compound the effects of poor sleep. Almost everyone knows the self-fulfilling drag of being wide awake and thinking, "Great, now I'm going to be exhausted tomorrow." More deleterious are the dark night of the soul thoughts that depressed or anxious people so often have. Everything that's wrong with your life feels even more wrong at 3 a.m. When dawn arrives, perhaps while you're on a run, you realize that things aren't as grim as they seemed. But the experience is draining. I've often wondered why those witching hour thoughts are always too dire. Why don't we ever lie awake thinking about how wonderful everything is, and then realize when the sun is up that our perceptions were overly rosy? Cecilia Bidwell considers adequate sleep, along with running, key to managing her anxiety. "I'm an 8-9 hours a day person," the attorney from Tampa says. "Here in Florida, I run super early in the summer because of the heat, and my Tuesday track group meets at 5 a.m., so those days I don't get as much sleep. But I'm pretty religious about going to bed early. One of the biggest triggers I have is getting even a little sleep-deprived." By being a runner, Bidwell and the rest of us are increasing our chances of good sleep. Exercise results in sleep that lasts longer and is of higher quality, more time spent in restorative, slow-wave sleep. Check that. Regular exercise improves sleep. Research on people with insomnia who begin an exercise program has found that it can take 3 to 4 months of regular workouts for the sleep-better effect to kick in. You've probably experienced acute incidents when running interferes with your sleep via legs that are still twitching post-20-miler or a still-stimulated nervous system after an evening track workout. Those days are the exception. Being a regular runner should mean better sleep and greater relief from depression or anxiety. Light therapy for seasonal affective disorder. Having depression is one of the risk factors for the calendar-specific form of depression known as seasonal affective disorder, SAD. The far more common type of SAD occurs in the winter and is marked by low energy, eating and sleeping too much, and withdrawing from social activities in favor of quasi-hibernation. Obviously, it can be difficult to distinguish the symptoms of SAD from how a depressed person feels in May or August. Thanks to my running log, I've been able to notice patterns over the years as the seasons change. Where I live, the sun sets just after 4 p.m. during all of December. That month's entries are much more likely than any other month's to include such phrases as beat again, in a rut, bagged group run, no oomph, and feeling chubby. I've noticed subtle improvements since I started using a light therapy box, which is thought to help by supplying in artificial form what the sun is skimping on that time of year. It's an unobtrusive enough process. Starting in early fall, I sit by the light almost immediately after getting out of bed, while having coffee, reading email, talking with my wife, and nudging our dog, who is at the lowest risk of depression of any mammal in history, out of the way. 20 to 30 minutes a day like this is sufficient. Light boxes don't emit ultraviolet B rays, the sun's vitamin D source. In addition to being triggered by altered circadian rhythms, it's believed that one reason depression worsens in the winter is lower vitamin D levels. In summer, between latitudes of 30 degrees north and 60 degrees north, from Houston to just south of Anchorage, Alaska, it takes only 15 minutes of midday sun to provide about 80% of the recommended daily amount of vitamin D. In the winter, not only is there far less sunlight, but what sunlight there is transmits negligible amounts of ultraviolet B rays to the skin. In addition, many people are indoors for large chunks of the scant daylight time. As runners, we have a regular opportunity to get some of that ultraviolet B light. Of course, during the shortest days of the year, fitting running into a normal work schedule often means starting and finishing runs in the dark. If possible, plan at least weekend runs for daylight hours. I try to do more morning runs in the winter. The 2 p.m. blahs when I haven't run yet are worse in January than July. Meeting others to run is especially helpful at that time of year in getting your butt out of the door and forcing you to socialize. Running and alcohol. Alcohol is part of much of running culture, from post-race beer tents and winery-sponsored events to beer miles and rehydrating after a warm run with a cold pale ale. In Longmont, Colorado, you can swing by Shoes and Brews, a running store with more than 20 craft beers on tap to choose from after doing a group run from the shop. Shoes and Brews is emblematic of how the majority of runners can happily mix miles and mugs with no significant adverse outcomes. That's not necessarily the case for people with depression and anxiety. According to a National Institutes of Health report, depression and anxiety are significantly associated with substance abuse. The report estimates that about 20% of people with a substance abuse disorder have depression and/or anxiety, and that about 20% of people with depression and/or anxiety have a substance abuse disorder. The report encourages medical professionals to consider mental health issues when treating people for substance abuse and vice versa. So many people using substances are medicating themselves for anxiety or depression, says Frank Brooks, Ph.D., a therapist and clinical social worker in Portland, Maine. They're trying to alter their mood. One of the reasons why it's so difficult to maintain sobriety over time is not because people don't have good intentions or don't know what to do. It's that they become overwhelmed by the anxiety or they slip into a depression and self-medicate again. Rehab programs often encourage people in recovery to run or do other exercise. In his book, Spark, John Rady, MD, writes, "As a treatment, exercise works from the top down in the brain, forcing addicts to adapt to a new